Welcome back, everyone, to 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries Podcast. This is your host, John Hagedorn. Today, we begin the story of the tragic sinking of the steamboat Sultana on April 27, 1865, which was carrying 1,960 Union prisoners of war who had been released from the Confederate prisons at Andersonville, Georgia, and Cahaba, Alabama, and a full crew, as well as a group of Christian women who accompanied the men to provide care for the weak and malnourished prisoners who needed help the most. Of the 2,128 persons who were jammed aboard the overcrowded steamer when the boilers exploded, 1,169 of them lost their lives after being tossed or forced to jump from the fiery boat into the frigid waters of the Mississippi River. Many bodies were never found. The disaster was quickly overshadowed by historic events, as General Lee had surrendered to General Ulysses S. Grant at Appomattox on April 9th, and the newspapers were focused on that, as well as on the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln at Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C., a story which became more intense every day as the plot was revealed and the search for John Wilkes Booth and his colleagues intensified. To a nation which had been pounded with news of war and death and now the loss of a beloved president, the news of the sinking of a boat full of freed Union prisoners, unfortunately and sadly, was just a passing headline. We'll tell the whole story here, and it's a story not only of the will to survive, but of greed, corruption, mismanagement, and very possibly sabotage. And yes, there are a number of theories which account for that, as well as a deathbed confession from a Southern agent who claimed responsibility for the sinking of a number of Union boats, including the Sultana. We will also bring in the survivor accounts, which recall the panic and fear experienced by those who lived through the explosion and the aftermath. Men who were already severely weakened by malnutrition in deadly Confederate prison camps. The Sultana tragedy is an incredible story of survival under the toughest of circumstances. The Sultana was built of wood in wartime in 1863 in the John Lithberry Boatyard in Cincinnati, Ohio, for the purpose of supporting the lower Mississippi cotton trade. She registered 1,719 tons and carried a crew of 85 most times. She ran a regular route between St. Louis and New Orleans and was frequently commissioned to carry troops. Her capacity was 376 passengers, but on that day she was carrying 2,128 souls, over five times her capacity, when three of the boat's four boilers exploded, causing the ship to catch fire and sink in the Mississippi River near Memphis, Tennessee. No one was ever held accountable for the disaster. The Sultana was captained by Captain James Cass Mason of St. Louis, who piloted her out of St. Louis, headed for New Orleans, on April 13, 1865. On the morning of the 15th, she was tied up at Cairo, Illinois, when news of President Lincoln's assassination arrived there via the newspapers, and Captain Cass bought an armload of papers to pass to the towns they would be docking in downriver, knowing the telegraph lines to those towns had been totally cut off by Confederate agents. When he reached Vicksburg, Mississippi, Mason was approached by Captain Reuben Hatch, the chief quartermaster at Vicksburg, with a proposal. Thousands of recently released Union prisoners of war who had been held at Confederate prison camps at Cahaba, Alabama, and Andersonville, Georgia, had been brought to a small parole camp outside of Vicksburg to await release to the northern states. Hatch said that the U.S. government would pay $2.75 per enlisted man and $8 per officer to any steamboat captain who would take a group north. Knowing that Mason was in need of money, Hatch suggested that he could guarantee Mason a full load of about 1,400 prisoners if Mason would agree to give him, Hatch, a kickback. Mason quickly agreed to Hatch's offer, hoping to make a good gain himself. But first he had to repair a boiler leak. While the paroled prisoners, primarily from the states of Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Virginia, were brought from the parole camp to Sultana, a mechanic was brought down to work on the leaky boiler. Although the mechanic wanted to cut out and replace a ruptured seam, Mason knew such a job would take a few days and cost him his precious load of prisoners. By the time the repairs would have been completed, the prisoners would have been sent home on other boats. Instead, Mason and his chief engineer, Nathan Wintringer, convinced the mechanic to make temporary repairs, hammering back the bulged boilerplate and riveting a patch of lesser thickness over the seam. Instead of taking 2 or 3 days, the temporary repair took only one. During her time in port, and while the repairs were being made, Sultana took on the paroled prisoners. Mason was overjoyed with the fact that he was cashing in on 1,400 prisoners and that he had saved money by skimping on repairs. But more money was coming his way in the form of additional prisoners, and despite the fact that his boat was already 400% overcrowded, he was about to take on another 500 prisoners. A mix-up with the parole camp books and suspicion of bribery from other steamboat captains caused the Union officer in charge of the loading, Captain George Augustus Williams, to place every man at the parole camp on board Sultana, believing the number to be less than 1,500. Although Sultana had a legal capacity of only 376, by the time she backed away from Vicksburg on the night of April 24th, she was severely overcrowded, with over 1,951 paroled prisoners, 22 guards from the 58th Ohio Volunteer Infantry, over 70 fare-paying cabin passengers, and 85 crew members, for a total of 2,128 people. Many of the paroled prisoners had been weakened by their incarceration and associated illnesses, but had managed to gain some strength while waiting at the parole camp to be officially released. The men were packed into every available space, as all cabin spaces were already filled with civilian passengers. The overflow was so severe that in some places the decks had begun to creak and sag and had to be supported with heavy wooden beams. The Sultana slowly pulled out of Vicksburg and spent 2 days traveling upriver, fighting against one of the worst spring floods in the river's history. Overloaded as she was, that alone would have put tremendous pressure on the boilers. At some places, the river overflowed the banks and spread out 3 miles wide. Trees along the riverbank were almost completely covered until only the very tops of the trees were visible above the swirling, powerful water. On April 26th, Sultana stopped at Helena, Arkansas, where photographer Thomas W. Banks took a picture of the grossly overcrowded vessel. I'll put that picture online at 1001 Heroes Facebook page. Sultana subsequently arrived at Memphis, Tennessee, around 7 o'clock p.m., and the crew began unloading 120 tons of sugar from the hold. Near midnight, Sultana left Memphis, leaving behind about 200 very lucky men. She then went a short distance upriver to take on a new load of coal from some coal barges and then, at about 1 a.m., started north again. At around 2 a.m. on April 27, 1865, when Sultana was about 7 miles north of Memphis, its boilers suddenly and violently exploded, killing many people instantly. First one boiler exploded, followed a split second later by two more. The massive steam explosion came from the top rear of the boilers. It went upward at a 45-degree angle, tearing through the crowded decks above and completely destroying the pilot house. Without a pilot to steer the boat, Sultana became a drifting, burning hulk. The violent explosion flung some deck passengers into the water and blew a gaping 25 to 30-foot hole in the steamer. With the boilers blown to pieces, the twin smokestacks fell, the starboard smokestack fell backward into the blasted hole, and the port smokestack fell forward into the crowded forward section of the upper deck, hitting the steamboat's bell as it fell. The forward part of the upper deck collapsed onto the middle deck, killing and trapping many in the wreckage. Fortunately, the sturdy railings around the twin openings of the main stairway prevented the upper deck from crushing down completely onto the middle deck. The men located around the twin openings quickly crawled under the wreckage and down the main stairs. Further back, the collapsing decks formed a slope that led down into the exposed furnace boxes. The broken wood caught fire and turned the remaining superstructure into a raging inferno. Survivors panicked and raced for the safety of the water, but in their weakened condition, they soon ran out of strength and began to cling to each other. Whole groups drowned together. We'll return with survivor accounts right after these sponsor messages. And now, back to the Sultana tragedy, Part 1. We can thank Sylvia Clemens, writer and guest speaker, for this piece she contributed online in 2014, which summarizes Isaac Noah Davenport's record of his experience on the Sultana. She writes, "Isaac Noah Davenport wrote a 15-page account of his ordeal during the Civil War and passed along his experience to his relatives. His nephew, Gordon H. Turner, also wrote a book called The History of Scotts Hill, Tennessee, and featured his uncle's story, which can be found on page 194. Davenport is one of the men who survived his experience of not only the Civil War or the horrible conditions they faced in Andersonville Prison, but also survived the Sultana steamboat explosion, which occurred at 2 a.m. on April 27, 1865. He was on his way home as the Civil War had just ended. Isaac had enrolled into the Union Army on August 28, 1862, for a 3-year service as a private. He was assigned to Company C of the 7th Tennessee Cavalry Volunteers. During the war, he was stationed at Union City, Tennessee. On March 24, 1864, the fort came under siege by Confederates who claimed that General Nathan Bedford Forrest was on his way with reinforcements. The Union commander surrendered the fort, believing that they would surely be massacred if Forrest arrived. They were marched southward to be imprisoned at Andersonville, Georgia. Davenport described one of their stops where they were held was a fenced-in cotton shed. I believe this to be the Cahaba prison in Alabama, where there is a record of him being held. They did not have beds, only the sandy hills, and a few had ragged blankets to wrap themselves at night, but only a few. He witnessed so many men's deaths, he was afraid he would succumb to that fate as well, but he would immediately think of his home and friends, which brought him encouragement that he himself might reach home one day. There was one soldier he referred to as one of his brethren by the name of S.F. McCollum, and he was so sick, Davenport wrapped his blanket around him and bid him goodbye as they started marching once again for Andersonville. He never saw his friend again. In October of 1864, Davenport said he was hurried off to Savannah, Georgia, where he remained some time. He was hurried off to Blackshear at Pine Grove, where they took shelter under branches and slept once again on the ground. They were there a few days until they were transported to Thomasville, Georgia. Then on February 15, 1865, they were happy to hear of orders to start preparing to march, as this brought them closer to going home. They had to march on foot for about 40 miles across the Pine Hills of Georgia. Even though many of them were weak and feeble, just the thoughts of being released and going home gave them encouragement to keep going. They were put on rail cars in Albany, Georgia, and taken to Andersonville, Georgia, where once again they found themselves in prison. Davenport described it as a desperate and gloomy-looking place. They didn't know what to expect. At one time, they noticed Confederate soldiers standing in little groups as if they were studying what to do, and that made them think something was going to happen pretty soon. While there, they experienced many horrible scenes through all types of weather conditions and stated they were nothing more than just skeletons at that point. He was a witness to 6 men being hung on one pole, which is now known as the Raiders. Davenport referred to them as thieves and murderers that killed and robbed several men that didn't have much to begin with anyways. He stated for the most part they had sympathy towards one another and would help each other as much as they could. At sunrise on March 20th, 1865, the word came that the prisoners would be exchanged and they were soon ordered to fall in line. They didn't take much time till they were soon embarked on the Confederate cars which carried them to Jackson, Mississippi. Once there, they had to travel on foot to Black River Bridge for several miles until they reached the river. He never mentioned what that place was called, but merely stated once that they were met by soldiers carrying that brave old flag and were given food and drink, as well as some clean clothes. I believe this to be Camp Fisk outside of Vicksburg, where many other soldiers are known to have also journeyed. Davenport describes remaining there in place with plenty until they were to board a steamboat which would then carry them north to Camp Chase, Ohio, and from there to be sent home. On April 25, 1865, Davenport, along with many others, boarded the Sultana steamboat that was waiting for them at the port. He described them being as thick as bees on board. but they were so glad they marched right on. They moved out around 10 o'clock, moving very slow, as the river was very high and swift from the spring rains. He then describes landing at Memphis, Tennessee, about 9 o'clock the next night, where some unloading and loading took place and stayed some time. Many of the soldiers got off and got something to eat, but Davenport was listening at all times for the signal bell to ring, which did, about 11 o'clock. Once back on the steamboat, they had to find a spot on deck to lay down. He, along with some other guys, went around on the outside of the banisters of the middle deck. They used their shoes, hats, and coats for their bedding. He had not been asleep long when he was awakened by a loud noise. Even though he had seen many horrible things while a prisoner, it wasn't anything compared to what he saw that night. Men's faces were white as sheets with fear, and they were jumping overboard as if wolves were after them. Some men were drowning and some burning, while many others were crying out for help from being smashed. He said that some were killed instantly, and others were scared to death, while others burned away. He himself was slightly wounded by a pile of timber, and two of his buddies that were on each side of him, named Isaac Smith and Guan Fowler, both died. He stated that Isaac Smith was killed instantly as his head was smashed, and Fowler spoke, saying, "Boys, I'm a dead man." He didn't see Fowler any more after he fell off into the river. Davenport met up with another one of the men he had become friends with while in prison, Morgan L. Gray. Davenport asked him what they should do, so his friend told him to tear up some strings, and he would tear up some planks and tie them together and swim out on them. Davenport stepped to the bow of the boat to see if he could see any chance for them to make their escape, but when he went back to Gray, Gray wasn't there. Davenport thought he'd drowned and was left alone once more. He couldn't swim very well and didn't like the idea of having to just jump into the river, but he was running out of time and had to do something. By this time, the flames and smoke were bursting through all parts of the burning boat. He didn't want to stay on boat and burn to death, so he got another piece of plank and jumped. As soon as he hit the water, someone snatched his plank away, and he was left to help himself the best he could. While trying to swim, a nearby drowning man grabbed him and carried him beneath the river. They struggled until he thought he was about to drown himself. He finally broke free by what he stated was the strength of God. Weakened by the struggle, he knew he couldn't make it to shore, so he started back towards the hulk of the boat when he was struck in the head by another piece of plank which he held onto until the break of day when he saw a large piece of timber fall from the top of the boat. He managed to get from the plank onto the log. After settling down, he saw a man swinging on a rope. He paddled over to him and pulled up a little. The man spoke as if he wasn't sure if he was dead or alive. Two men with a raft spotted them and rescued not only them, but all the men they could reach at that time who were alive. Davenport stated he was one of nine that got away from the burning boat. They were taken to a large sycamore tree and hustled off the raft, which then went back to save as many more as they could. Amusingly, even after going through all this, once these men were on the limbs of the tree, they shared wet tobacco, and after taking a good chew, amused themselves in fitting the musketeers. He described he and his comrades as a happy little band as ever that sat on the limbs of a sycamore tree above the waves of the Mississippi River, just happy to be alive. The two rescuers came back at sunup and gathered them back up and took them to shore. As they were heading to shore, Davenport looked out to where the Sultana was and saw the hulk for the last time as it sunk beneath the waves. Others had built a good fire and were already warming themselves when another steamboat came to their rescue. That steamboat had about 80 survivors on board. They were taken back to Memphis. When they landed, they got off the boat where there was another group standing around a fire trying to dry themselves. Some of them swam the 7 miles from the burning boat. Surprisingly, he had seen his friend Gray. In a token of their friendship, they gave each other their hand of token as they thought the other had drowned. They marched up to the streets of Memphis barefooted as they had lost their shoes as well as their hats. They were wet and cold, but they soon reached the soldiers' home where they got some warm, dry clothes and something to eat. Davenport said there were about 8 of his regiment on the boat and 6 of them were lost. Only he and John Derryberry were left to tell their story. Morgan L. Gray and Alinthus G. Shelton were from the 6th Tennessee Cavalry Company E, but they were like brothers to them for their long prison life together. They all stayed at the soldiers' home a few days when they were ordered to their own states to be discharged. Davenport was discharged in Nashville, Tennessee, on June 29, 1865, and arrived back home in Scottsdale, Tennessee, on July 3, 1865. He died on September 16, 1922. The next account is from Sultana survivor Joseph Taylor Elliott, who wrote The Sultana Disaster in 1913. I will offer excerpts here. The first excerpt describes Joe Elliott's release from Andersonville and the pitiful condition of the soldiers, many of who died, on their walk to board the Sultana. He wrote, "There was never a happier lot of men than those who marched out of Andersonville prison on March 20, 1865, on the way to freedom. Not that any of them were in physical condition to cause happiness, but because of the horrors they were leaving and the comforts they hoped soon to find. The rosiest dreams of children on Christmas Eve are no fairer than the visions that floated through their minds at that time. I was one of them. I had been captured at Spring Hill, near Franklin, Tennessee, in November of 1864, and had been transported with other unfortunates to Andersonville by way of Meridian, Selma, and Montgomery, so that I had over 2 months in the hell on earth, and that was long enough to gain a residence that could never be forgotten, though I think that the officer's pen, in which I was confined, was not quite so bad as the main pen where the private soldiers were kept. There was no ceremony about our release. We were simply told that the hour of deliverance had come, and without giving us time to arrange our toilets, which indeed was not necessary, as there was nothing to make them with, we were marched up to the railroad to await the train for Montgomery. We'd been there a short time when the prisoners from the large pen began to come up. It was one of the most pitiful sights I ever beheld, and I doubt very much if Ezekiel's vision in the Valley of Dry Bones excelled it. Coming like cattle across an open field were scores of men who had nothing but skin and bones, some hobbling along as best they could, and others being helped by stronger comrades. Every gaunt face with its staring eyes told the story of the suffering and privation they had gone through, and protruding bones showed through their scanty, tattered garments. One might have thought that the grave and the sea had given up their dead. They waited patiently for the train, but when it finally arrived, it was a wild scramble to get on board, every man for himself, as if in terror lest he be left behind. But there were some, like the one at the Pool of Siloam, who were unable to help themselves and had to be lifted on like little children. But in wretched plight as we were, it was a great pleasure to meet the boys of my company after our weeks of separation, at least those that were left, for some had died in prison. And there were others who barely escaped it, for there was hardly a station on the road where we did not leave the remains of some poor fellow to be buried by strangers. How hard to die in the morning of their deliverance, with all the bright hopes of meeting father, mother, wife, or children. It is not strange that those whose memories go back to such scenes should find it hard to restrain a feeling of bitterness toward those who caused the war, with all its sacrifice and suffering. A tiresome ride of several hours on the cars brought us to Montgomery, where we were transferred to a steamboat that was waiting for us. While at the wharf, I met my first outside acquaintance, in the person of a colored man who had been a slave of the proprietor of Montgomery Hall, in whose employ I had been when I resided in Montgomery for a time before the war. The boat soon backed out into the river, and we were quickly out of sight of that beautiful city. Within a few hours, we were landed at Selma, where we took cars again from Meridian, Mississippi. The Pullmans on which we were loaded were of the kind commonly used for four-footed passengers, and the more active of us took upper berths on top of the cars. This proved rather dangerous, for our car had an accident, and some of the boys were thrown off and badly bruised. I escaped injury by jumping to the car ahead. We had another transfer to a steamboat on the Tombigbee River, and then train cars again to Meridian, where we were informed that we would have to make the rest of our journey on foot. They simply turned us loose and directed us to the road to Vicksburg, near which the parole camp was located. After a wearisome march, we came to the Big Black, which was the Jordan for us, with no Joshua to command the waters to roll back. We had to wait till the ferryman had orders to take us over, and we were probably more patient in doing so because we could see the stars and stripes floating over the parole camp. It was too far away to see even the stripes, but we knew it was the old flag as it floated out. I felt that I loved it as I never had before. Perhaps every American would appreciate it more if he were obliged to live for a while away from its protection. Long may it wave, or the land of the free and the home of the brave. In a few hours we were in camp, and soon had some coffee, and surprised our stomachs with other good things. The camp was under the command of rebel officers, but was guarded by colored Union troops. This was due to the fact that we were to be paroled, not exchanged, as has sometimes been stated. The authorities had stopped the exchange of prisoners on the ground that we were releasing sound men who could at once take care of themselves. There was not a day when we remained in the parole camp that I was not in some part of the ground that was contested in the advance of Vicksburg. With the choice of positions the rebels had and the natural advantages presented, it was almost a mystery how the troops under General Grant could have advanced as close as they did to the rebel line. But it would not do for me to start on General Grant, for, like the old-time Democrats with General Jackson, I would be willing to continue to vote for him during the balance of my days. On April 24, 1865, our paroles having been arranged, we were taken from the camp to the city and embarked on the ill-fated steamboat Sultana, bound for Cairo, Illinois. The men were marched onto the hurricane deck of the boat, around to the cabin, and then to the lower deck, until all the available space was occupied, including the fore part of the decks, the cabin being occupied by the officers. Most of the men were emaciated and weak, being prisoners released from Andersonville and Cahaba prisons, with a few from other points. The Sultana was a boat that had been built for the cotton trade of the lower river, and therefore her lower deck was higher than that of the ordinary boats. She was on an up trip from New Orleans to St. Louis, and had on board a number of passengers, many of whom were to get off at Memphis. I remember a particular one, a gentleman from near Madison, Indiana, who had come down to see his son, a member of the 10th Indiana Cavalry, who had been a prisoner. There were perhaps half a dozen women, one of whom was a bride returning with her husband from their bridal tour. My recollection is that the crew numbered about 62, and that in all there were over 2,200 souls on board. My recollection is confirmed by a letter from F. A. Rosine, dated at the 72nd Regiment Illinois Infantry Volunteer, Rookery Building, Chicago, 1912, in which he says, "I was an AAAG of Camp Fisk at 4 Mile Bridge near Vicksburg, where we received paroles, exchanged prisoners, etc. This camp was under the immediate command of General M. L. Smith, commanding post of Vicksburg. The superior command was in General J. N. T. Dana and his AAG Captain Frederick Speed, who controlled the shipment of the last squad of the camp on April 25, 1865. I have reason to remember the deplorable occurrence from the reprimand I received from Captain Speed for advancing the impression to the men that they were to be apportioned to different boats. At the time, I had a list of the officers and men shipped on the ill-fated steamer Sultana. Their aggregate number from each state was Ohio, 552, Michigan, 420, Indiana, 460, Kentucky, 180, West Virginia, 12, Tennessee, 522, for a total of 2,134 men. Added to this list was a squad of Confederate prisoners under guard, on their way to another military prison camp, other passengers, and the crew. At Vicksburg, the loss was estimated at 1,900 lives. Someone was certainly at fault for crowding so great a number of human beings on one boat, when there was no emergency calling for it, and especially so great a number of men who were so reduced in strength that they were not able to do much for themselves in case of an accident. Someone should have been held responsible, but I cannot say who it should have been from my own knowledge. I add the report of the official investigation as to that matter. Captain Mason, the commander of the boat, and a citizen of St. Louis, was as congenial a gentleman as I ever met, and afterward proved as brave as he was clever. As I saw him at all times of day between Vicksburg and Memphis, I became quite well acquainted with him. He was a careful man, the captain was. I remember his cautioning the men not to crowd on one side of the boat when making a landing, because the tilting of the boat and its return to a level position would endanger the boilers. The men managed this very well, except at a few places, especially Helena, Arkansas, where they all tried to get a view of the place. The first night, about 9 o'clock, they commenced putting up cots in the cabin. The passengers were provided for first, and some of us were left unprovided for. I got the assurance, however, that when we got to Memphis, I would have one of the cots that would then be vacated. Until we reached Memphis, my bed was on the cabin floor, immediately over the boiler which afterward caused the terrible catastrophe. We landed at Memphis just after dark on the 26th, and many of the passengers left us at this point, it being reported among the men that the boat would be at Memphis for some time, and there being no control over us, a number of us took advantage of the occasion to go up into the city in search of amusement. I was soon satisfied and returned to the boat, which shortly after moved out into the river and pulled upstream to take on coal, leaving about 150 fortunate soldiers behind. We took coal from the boat that appeared to be out in the river, but the Mississippi at that time was over the whole country on account of floods in the upper river and the Missouri. The water was much colder than would have been supposed, as the trees were all in leaf. In the meantime, the cots had been put up in the cabin, as usual, and I went in and threw my hat on the first cot toward the bow of the boat, while we went forward to get what little worldly goods had come into my possession at Vicksburg. On coming back, I found my cot occupied by Captain McCoy, I think of the 158th Ohio, who refused to give it up. We were having some very unpleasant words about it, when Lou Keeler, of the 11th Indiana, came along and persuaded me to release my claim and take a cot at the back end of the cabin, under the one he had occupied. The cots were double-deckers, one above and one below. It was some time after midnight when I retired. The last person I talked with was Captain Mason, and if I believed in presentiments, I would believe that he had one, that something dreadful was going to happen. For in our conversation, he said that he would give all the interest he had in the boat if it were safely landed in Cairo. I was impressed at the time by what he said, but in a few moments it wore off. It was not long after getting into my cot until I was in the land of dreams. How long I slept, I cannot say, but it must have been about 3 o'clock in the morning when I was awakened. My first sensation was of a very oppressive heat, and the first thought that came into my mind was that I was in the regions of eternal torment. At this point, we take a break from Joe Elliott's narrative to describe what was happening at that moment. While the Sultana burned, and the men on the steamboat were either already dead or fighting for their lives, the southbound steamer, Bostonia, built in 1860, but coming downriver on her maiden voyage after being refurbished, arrived at about 2:30 a.m., a half hour after the explosion, and rescued scores of survivors. At the same time, dozens of people began to float past the Memphis waterfront, calling for help, until they were noticed by the crews of the docked steamboats and U.S. warships, who immediately set about rescuing the survivors. Eventually, the hulk of Sultana drifted about 6 miles to the west bank of the river and sank at around 7 a.m. near Mound City and present-day Marion, Arkansas, about 5 hours after the explosion. Other vessels joined the rescue, including the steamers Silver Spray, Jenny Lind, and Pocahontas, the Navy Ironclad, USS Essex, and the sidewheel gunboat, USS Tyler. We'll return with the remainder of Joe Elliott's account, and many others, as well as theories regarding the sabotage of the Sultana, in Part 2, next Sunday at 12 noon Eastern Time. We encourage you to enjoy our other 1001 shows, including 1001 Classic Short Stories and Tales, where we offer a wide selection of hand-picked short stories from writers such as Ernest Hemingway, Edgar Allan Poe, and many others. and 1001 Stories for the Road, where I'm currently sharing an Agatha Christie Poirot mystery called The Mystery of the Blue Train, and 1001 Sherlock Holmes Stories, where you can enjoy the best of Sherlock Holmes as well as Arthur Conan Doyle's adventures, and many more. We also appreciate our Patreon supporters, who, for about the cost of a blended coffee each month, support our show's basic expenses. And yes, we have advertisers, as well as those who support us, but every time you hear me announce an advertiser and no advertisement follows, that signals a great need for a Patreon supporter to step up and give us a hand. We deliver so much free entertainment here at 1001 Stories Network, and I've been doing this full-time for 9 years. Advertisers come and go. That's just the way their budgets work. They're usually on for 3 months, and then you don't see them again for quite a while. Many of our Patreon supporters have been with us since the beginning, every month. In part two, you're going to hear many more incredible accounts of this little-known disaster. All of these men who fought to hold our nation together deserved much better than a cold, watery grave, and this story honors their memory. Part two, next week. Don't miss it. Reviews are appreciated. We'll see you next Sunday.